Power Records presents...
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of the Power Records Podcast, where the action comes alive. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm one of your hosts, Rob Kelly, and joining me as always is my pal,
Chris Franklin.
Howdy, Chris.
Hey, Rob, how's it going?
It's great. We are back with the new episode of the Power Records Podcast, the oft-demanded Power Records Podcast. And Chris, would you agree with me in saying that the topic that we're about to tackle is probably the most requested franchise of the Power Records stable that we haven't gotten to yet?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think this, because we've, this is definitely the one that we haven't touched that everybody's like, when are you going to do this? So, you're definitely right.
Yeah, we've done multiple episodes on different characters and different, you know, properties that Power Records had the rights to, but we have never gotten to Space 1999 because we've been holding off. We've been holding off because we decided a long time ago that the only way we could properly talk about the Space 1999 Power Recorded audio adventures is if we have a ringer. And in this case, it's our pal and Space 1999 expert, Brian Heiler. Hi, Brian.
Hi, pleasure to be here. That's the first time I've ever been referred to as a ringer in anything.
I'm glad we could bring that into your life. This is very exciting. I said, we've been talking about, Chris and I decided we had to have you on when we were going to do Space 1999 for a long time. And we just weren't able to put it together. But now we're all here together. We're all floating in space here above Moonbase Alpha. So it's very, very exciting. So before we get to these records, the Space 1999 records, we do want to thank our sponsor, which in this case is InStockTrades.com. This episode of the Power Records Podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Chris, what do you got?
Well, there was no Space 1999 comics or books
on... I looked for those too.
Unfortunately, but I got as close as I could. I got Star Trek Classic UK Comics Volume 2, since Space 1999 was a UK production. Why not? So this is has art by Carlos Pino and Vicente Alcazar. The second volume fills in another major gap in Star Trek lore, courtesy of these never-before-reprinted comics that originally appeared in weekly British magazines in the early 1970s.
Oh, like the TV21s.
Yeah, I guess that's where it came from. Yeah, these are the UK.
I love those.
Yeah, these are the UK voyages of the Starship Enterprise, and now at last, fans everywhere can experience them. As a special bonus, Rich Hanley provides the first half of a detailed encyclopedia of all things Star Trek from these British comics. The regular price is $49.99. In stock trade price is $34.99. You save 30%. And yeah, I'd say this might be some of the stuff that showed up in those British annuals I know you love, Brian.
Yeah. No, actually, that stuff appeared in weekly comics, and I had them as a kid.
Oh, okay. And
weirdly enough, I know Rich Handley, too.
Oh, okay, cool. Small world.
Yeah, it is. When you mentioned that name, I was like, I know that guy. Yeah, no, I love the art in those.
Oh, cool. Well, see, there you go, guys. Brian just gave you all the motivation you need. Go to InStock Trades and buy this book.
Yeah, well, the one thing that's really lovely about those is that they take a little bit of liberty with it. I remember, like, the Enterprise, like, flying up planets and, you know, landing and stuff like that. And it's like, I don't remember that on the show. But
Power Records gave us White Uhura, so, you know, I mean, can you go,
yeah,
you know?
funny you mention that.
So British Star Trek. Does that mean Sulu was on the right? Is that what that means? Is that exactly. How that works?
Okay. Well, you know, they say, let's get in the lift, you know.
Right. Right. Okay. Fair enough. Well, that's a really cool pick, Chris. And as you mentioned, yeah, there are no Space 1999 comics collected on InStock Trades. I don't even know if they've ever been collected at all.
Yeah.
Whether they're, They have. Okay. So, but they're not on the sub trades.
I've got a trade in the other room, but
of course you do, Brian.
Yes.
Why did I think anything else? So I got close. I kind of went the other way in that I picked some Charlton comics. In this case, the Silver Age Classics Space Adventures Slipcase Edition Volume 3 by Dick Giordano and Various. It collects Charlton Space Adventures, the 1952 series issues 11 through 15. This is the third volume of Charlton's Fit and Funky Space Adventures. Couldn't always make up its mind whether to go all out SF or all out horror, or as is in evidence here, a mix of the two. The ideal fodder for fans of I Married a Monster from Outer Space and Dan Dare plus Quatermass. Who's that? Hey, Melvin, see me when school's out. Yes, sir, this baby near on demands that you dig out that old goldfish ball and your holstered interstellar ray gun. If you're quick, you can probably fight off several groups of marauding space aliens before your mom calls you in for supper. Wow, whoever wrote that copy really went out of his way on the Ronin Stock Trades. It's 184 pages, features an amazingly fun kind of ECS cover of a space alien going after an astronaut who is blissfully unaware that she's about to be attacked by an alien. Normal price is $55.99, but in-stock trades price is $44.79. You save 20% off. Knowing what we know about Charlton, nobody at Charlton ever thought that they would be collecting their comics in this kind of permanent, yes, super deluxe edition 60 years later. It's kind of amazing to think that these things are getting this treatment. But it's cool because I love all these comics, and they're kind of hard to find. So this seems like a really handsome book.
Charlton paper always felt like weird when I was a kid. Like, mm-hmm, you get a Charlton comic, and you'd be like, what is this printed on?
A cereal box.
Yeah, cereal box, exactly.
That's what they were printing next. So there was probably carryover.
I found that later, but I just remember you always knew when you had a Charlton comic, like if your eyes were closed and you were just feeling through it, you'd get a splinter.
The color was weird, things like that.
Yeah. So for these and all the other trade paperback needs, visit instocktrades.com, and we thank them for their support. So, okay, guys, let's talk about Space 1999. Before we get to the records, we need to ask, I'll go around the horn here, we're starting with our guest, Brian. Like, what's your history with Space 1999?
The soft answer is just childhood. Mm-hmm. Space 1999 was a very ambitious, big-budget, syndicated television series from a company called ITC. And it was the brainchild of Jerry and Sylvia Anderson, who are a husband and wife couple, and they created a lot of notable popular children's programs in the 1960s. And then they started into live action beginning in the late 1960s with UFO. Then they had a series called, I think, The Persuaders, starring Robert Vaughn. And then reruns of UFO became popular in the United States, and ITC ordered a second season of UFO, but insisted it be only set on the moon. The show had a moon component, and then promptly pulled the plug on that. And there a lot of development had been done. So Anderson went to Lou Gray, the owner of ITC, and said, well, why don't we just do something with this premise, this moon based premise? And they did. They went all out. I think it helped at the time that reruns of Star Trek were, you know, dominating the landscape and be very popular with young people. So this was the time for a new science fiction series. And Space 1999 was a huge explosion. And I think I got roped into it mainly because it was very colorful. And there was just so much merchandise out there, namely things like these Power Records, that I became kind of fascinated with it. And when I turned about 13, I started getting I think I found a Space 1999 book at a grocery store. And that kind of triggered me into like, well, what else can I collect? And here we are to this day. So Space 1999 was actually very influential for me and at a very early age. And I, you know, it started with paperback books and Charlton comics of all things. And then it, you know, it led into models and Viewmasters. And I think honestly, these Power Records may have been like the third thing I found, because I took the train with a friend to downtown Toronto, which was big and scary in 1984. And I went to a place called the Silver Snail that's still in business. And they had these on the shelf when I walked in the door. And I mean, they've probably been sitting there since 1976. And that was it. That was the start of this. And I still have them.
Yeah. I mean, the show only lasted two seasons, so I mean, it wasn't that popular. I mean, was it just did all the merchandise come out because the idea was, oh, this is probably going to be a big hit? I mean, 2 years is not that long a run.
No, it's not. There's a lot of factors to that. It wasn't that it wasn't so popular. Its first year, you know, first of all, it was syndicated. And, you know, some networks, some places played it like at 7 o'clock. Some places, some network affiliates were playing it in lieu of what, like, CBS told them to play. Wow. So, you know, depending on where you lived in the United States, you could see it, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday or, you know, Friday night at 8. But the thing that should have been a third season. The thing that killed the third season was the cost. Lou Grade wanted to get into movie making, and he wanted to make a movie called Raise the Titanic, which, you know, as we know, is a celebrated classic. And
it's the most famous of the Titanic movies.
Yes, yes, of course. It is the one that everybody aspires to. And it's right up there with the Return to the Poseidon Adventure, whatever that is called. So what happened was, I guess, you know, he was on the fence about a third season of Space 99. It was still successful, and he just decided to gas it. Now, Martin Landau was especially pissed off about this. But the show also went through something that I think isn't parodied enough, which is, you know, the first season was very influenced by 2001.
Oh, boy, howdy.
Yeah, and so it's very metaphysical, and it's very ponderous, and there's lots of trippy episodes. And then, you know, there's a few, like, I think I was recommending a few to you, Chris, and, you know, I tend to recommend the ones with a little action or, you know, there's just something going on that's interesting. But there is some, you know, there's some bizarre episodes. And I guess it faced a lot of criticism, especially from Star Trek fans. And so they decided to retool for the second season, and they brought on Freddie Friedberger, who had most famously – well, he worked on like other shows, but most famously he worked on the third season of Star Trek. And they really thought they were hiring somebody who could, you know, bring the success of Star Trek, not realizing that this guy probably didn't actually, you know, he did okay, but he didn't make the best episode. You know, this guy's name is on Spock's brain. This is kind of a thing I joke with a friend about, is they kind of went like way too far the other way. Like the starting of season two is almost like comedic. It's almost like Anchorman. You know, like, I guess one of the complaints was the show didn't have enough action. So the second season, it's got this, like, emergency-type music. And the first opening scene is Martin Landau spinning in his chair and shooting his ray gun. And it's like, you know, Martin Landau is not exactly Joe Action, you know? Like, and, you know, and then you've got Barbara Bain, like, running down the hall. And you're just kind of like, okay, this is maybe tone this back a bit, guys. And they got rid of certain characters, which didn't help the merchandise. You know, all this merchandise is coming out with Barry Morse's faces on it, and he's nowhere to be seen on the show anymore. And, you know, they added a new character who I quite like, which is called Maya, and she's an alien, you know, sort of a Mr. Spock of the series. But, it's almost like Buck Rogers, where they had this kind of cool formula in the first season, and then they just kind of went too far in trying to make it different in the second season, you know? And, the same thing kind of happened with Space 1999. A lot of the plots are kind of silly. There's this predilection with monsters, and there's a really great documentary about Space 1999. I think it's on YouTube, where, you know, Gerry Anderson gets all these notes about monsters, monsters, more monsters, and he makes all these silly monster costumes. And then he gets a note back from New York. What are you doing with all these monsters? Like, they just didn't know. You know, there was too many cooks in the thing, and unfortunately, yeah, it only got two seasons, and it doesn't have the cult popularity I think it deserves. You know, it's something very special to me, but I understand it's completely flawed in many ways. But there's a lot of gold in those hills, you know, and there's some really innovative and amazing things done on that show. Star Wars was directly influenced by Space 1999. Not only did Lucas hire like a lot of the same people to do it, but like things like, you know, Space 1999 has the Eagle, so it's the 1999 Eagle. Han Solo drives the Millennium Falcon. And that actually is kind of an in-joke. And just things like that. Models being dirtied up was a Brian Johnston thing. You know, like models that don't look gleaming white and clean. And then, of course, that was a humongous trend-setting thing they did on Star Wars, where the spaceships looked a little dirty and ratty at times. And just things like that, little touches. A lot of the same actors were in it, you know, Peter Cushing, David Prowse. But it is something you can't show a young person now and go, this is good, because they will go, it's not, it's a little clunky. But, you know, I mean, I've got full-on nostalgia goggles. I've collected it for a long time, and it's something I still seriously do enjoy in life. I just, you know, I don't religiously watch it. I pop it on about once a year now. It's comfort food. It's well-made comfort food.
Chris, what's your history with the show, if you have one?
I didn't really have one before. It's kind of strange. I knew of this show, I think, from the Power Records, from like the inside sleeve. As far as I remember, it did not air anywhere in my area. I mean, it might be because by the time I would have really remembered it, it was the first run was over, and it doesn't have enough episodes for a lot of stations to try to syndicate it. I knew about it for years. I knew it had Martin Landau and Barbara Bain in it, and I knew them from Mission Impossible, which I did see in reruns. So I was, you know, I knew of it. I learned a lot more about it when, you know, I found Brian online on the Mego Museum and Plaid Stallions and things like that. And then, you know, when you put the Power Records up, but in doing right before, you know, I was like, well, we're going to do this. So I've got to watch some episodes of this, or I'm going to just look like, you know, be totally out of the loop here. So I think Tubi TV's like, it's free on Tubi TV right now, if you've got that on your Roku or whatever. And I watched the first episode, Breakaway, and I got to say, man, I really enjoyed it. I thought, hey, this, you know, I knew it was, you know, more cerebral. It was kind of like the kind of Star Trek that NBC initially rejected in that regard in some ways. But I really enjoyed it. Brian suggested a few more episodes, and I watched a couple of those. And I got to say, you know, my daughter was in the room with me when I was watching the last two, at least. And I'm not saying she's going to say, hey, Dad, let's watch Space 1999, but she got into it. You know, she actually was following the story. So I guess,
Ones were you watching?
I was watching the Death's Domain, Other Domain with Ryan Blessed in the Ice Planet. Mm-hmm. And then I watched
Dragon's Domain.
Dragon's Domain, the one where the guy, the freaking Cthulhu thing in space, is like, wow, there's some like pretty horrific moments in both of those episodes. It's like,
oh,
they
go
full on like creep show level, like, you know, desiccated, like smoking corpses in both of those episodes.
It's like, almost like Hammer Horror in space.
Which, you know, of course, I respond to.
the Cushing episode has some, it's a slow moving episode, but it has some horrific scenes in it.
Oh, cool. I'll have to check that one out because it's, you know, got Cushing in that. But yeah, I've really been digging it. So I'll tell you, after we're done doing this, I'm going to go watch some more of them. I expected to somewhat enjoy it, but I liked it a lot more than I expected to, just without really knowing, you know, nothing beyond just the base, and with absolutely no nostalgia for it, it still works. So, I mean,
of course, I'm here actually.
Yeah, I'm predisposed to this type of stuff, obviously, you know, but yeah, I'm definitely interested in watching the whole run and seeing how it changes in season two, even though, yeah, Buck Rogers season two, ooh, yeah, other than Hawk, that's a little rough.
it's a little better than that, but, okay, you know, I think Buck Rogers actually, I use that example because I think season one was totally working.
Yes,
on Buck Rogers. Like, it was, they found their groove. I don't know why they did that. But Space 1999, I don't think needed to be as tweaked as severely as they did.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I remembered, I watched Space 1999 as a kid. I remember watching it at our house in Philadelphia in the 70s, and it aired. I mean, I had to have caught it after Star Wars had already come out, and at that point, I was just into everything space related. I'd already watched Star Trek, so I was already predisposed. But then after Star Wars, I think I was like, yeah, anything with space in it that I can watch. So I remember watching Space 1999, and I had not seen an episode in the intervening 40 years until the previous weekend, where I decided to watch a couple in preparation for the show. And I watched Breakaway, and boy, yeah, like you mentioned, I mean, my God, this thing is 2001 right from the very beginning. I mean, that scene of them in the spacesuits, I'm like, this looks exactly like Kubrick. And I'm like, that's ambitious to try and do on a TV budget, a sort of something visually similar to the ambition displayed.
Really keeping me in suspense here.
I watched Breakaway.
I liked it. I mean, I did like it. It's weird. It's a weird show. But it's, like I said, I appreciated the ambition of it, of how just that it was sort of cerebral and sort of realistic looking. And despite the – I'm sure the reason it was airing on TV was because of Star Wars, and yet it is not Star Wars. It is –
Well, it was pre-Star Wars, actually.
Right, but I mean, I'm thinking it aired in our market because of Star Wars.
Oh, I see. Yeah, they were playing all kinds of – yeah, anything that had spaceships in it when I was a kid.
Right, and that's why I was watching it, was because of Star Wars, and yet it was not – it's not Star Wars in the least.
No, it's not even close.
Yeah. But I did enjoy its quirky weirdness. I love the opening credits, the kind of psychedelic, wah, 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 wah. Like the credits are interspersed with scenes, and then it's very, very. And then I did kind of, I have to admit, go down the rabbit hole of Space 1999 trivia, of just stuff that I read about it. And you hinted at some of the stuff, Brian, about some of the behind the scenes shenanigans. And my favorite piece of Space 1999 trivia that I found was on IMDb, and it says, shortly before his death in the early 2000s, producer Fred Freiberger showed up at a science fiction convention and attempted to defend his actions regarding Space 1999's second season. He was booed off the podium. So good to know that Space 1999 fans can be as big a dick as Star Wars fans can be. It's like, yeah, you're gonna pick on this old man right before he died.
That documentary came out in around 99 for Space 1999, and that's really the first time I've ever heard anyone throw him under the bus, and it's done in a British way. They all go, oh, he's a lovely man, you know, and then follows is, you know, and the one that always gets me is there's an episode called The Rules of Luton, which is the arena episode of Star Trek. But you know, they come on a planet, and the planet is inhabited by intelligent trees and grass, so just by picking a flower they're sentenced to death. And I guess Gerry Anderson's story behind that was, you know, Freddie Freiberger drove in one morning and he had to drive by a town called Luton. And he's like, I've got a new episode, The Rules of Luton. And like, they were all like, you mean Luton? You know, like, I find that really like right out of a movie. That's weird. And that's just some of the stuff that they were coming up with. I find it all kind of like perplexing and hilarious, but I don't know if I'd boo him. I don't think I have that.
That's so mean.
Negative energy in me. But
I feel like he's kind of the worms kind of turned with him in Star Trek. Though most people, for years they blamed him for Star Trek season 3. Like, you know, the fact that the in general, Star Trek season 3 was kind of like, it's like the quality really dipped in 3. And but I think people have it's kind of come around, and there's like, you know, yeah, there's, you know, Spock's brain and thing in episodes like that, you know, but
that's one of my favorite. I'm telling you right now, and maybe this says a lot about me, but Spock's brain, The Way to Eden, Whom Gods Destroy, Let That Be Your Last Battlefield are some of my favorite episodes of Star Trek, and they're all season 3.
Yeah, Day of the Dove is one of my favorites, and that's season 3. Yeah.
Spectre of the Gun and
Spectre of the Gun.
Space Lincoln in the Savage Gun.
Savage Curtain's amazing.
Day and the Doves, where they're on the Klingons are on the ship with the entity that's making the fight.
That's another winner. Like yeah. the episode I hate more than anything is the one, and I don't think it's like a season one episode where the Lazarus episode, you know,
alternative factor, yeah,
alternative. Like, that is the worst thing I've ever seen. I've seen it once.
Yeah,
and that was when I was like 11, and I was like, I will never watch this again, and I never have. So yeah, no, I'm a big season 3 fan, to be honest with you. So yeah, I don't have beef.
Yeah, Chris, I agree with you. I think that people know now that, you know, the whatever deficits season 3 had were not Fred Freiberger's fault. So that just made me sad to hear that, you know, this kind of kindly old man showed up to defend his work from 20 years previous and people booed him off. It's like, man, nerds are just the worst. They're just the worst people in the world. Like, oh my God. We're so picked upon, and then we can't wait to pick on other people. This is the worst. So okay, we've been talking forever about Space 1999. We should actually play one of these records
we're
talking about. We need to get – so we've been talking about Breakaway. That's the first episode of Space 1999. One we're going to play of two that we're going to play here for the show is the very first episode. It's an adaptation of Space 1999. So let's get right to it. The first record we're going to hear is Space 1999, Breakaway.
It is the year 1999, on Moonbase Alpha. Preparations for a manned probe of the recently discovered planet Meta are almost complete. The new commander of Alpha, John Koenig, is getting some last-minute information from the head of the Space Commission, calling from Earth.
How do you like this, John? The first close-up shot of the planet Meta, taken from the unmanned Space Bearer 9, just in.
It has atmosphere.
Not only that, we're receiving signals loud and clear. The planet Meta could be supporting life as we know it. We must make a manned landing. Nothing must stop us, John. Nothing.
Well, John, good to see you again.
Professor Bergman. Victor, still here.
Yes, I got caught. Listen, John, things are far more serious than I suspect you've been told. People are dying up here.
The virus infection?
Well, Dr. Russell doesn't believe it is a virus. Looks very much like the effects of radiation, but I am not...
But what?
There is no radiation.
Look, Victor, you know me well enough to know that I'm not going to ignore the fact that people have been dying up here. But the space launch of the century must not be allowed to slip through our fingers. That planet is passing just close enough to make a landing. This medical problem must be solved. There's no margin for error.
Dr. Russell has some ideas worth listening to. Why don't you talk to her, John?
Commander, our ninth man died this morning. One moment he's fine. The next he had lost all control. Look at this thermographic plate. A malignancy erupts, and there's immediate disorientation of the kind that's classic in radiation attacks.
I understand, Doctor. You've had 11 cases so far.
9 deaths.
But all 9 who died were workers in Nuclear Disposal Area 2. The 2 astronauts with the same illness never went near that site. It's inconsistent.
There's another inconsistency. There is no radiation in Area 2.
What about the backup crew? Are they medically clear to fly this mission?
They appear to be, but they've lived the same lives, been through the same training as the critically ill probe astronauts. I can't guarantee that they won't be affected. 3 days or 3 months out in deep space.
Dr. Russell, the 2 astronauts. Come quick.
Well, Doctor?
It's over. They're both gone.
If it's the last thing I do, I'll find out why those 2 men died. Paul, I'm going to recheck the radiation levels of Area 2 myself. Get an Eagle ready. I'll need 2 volunteers.
Yes, sir.
I want Area 2, Collins, not 1.
That's where we're going, Commander. We just use Area 1 as a turning point. Navigation beacon Delta. It's a landmark.
Area 1. This was the first nuclear waste area up here. Has it been used since I left, Victor?
No, John. They've moved on to Area 2. This one hasn't been used for 5 years.
How's it holding up?
All right, according to reports. Constantly monitored, no radiation.
All right, Collins, let's move on to Area 2.
Landing at Area 2, Collins and Jackson go out on foot to check the radiation levels, while Koenig and Professor Bergman stay in the area monitoring depot.
Point 1, check complete. Radiation normal, no leakage. We're going on to point 48.
All right, Jackson.
Section by section, the 2 men check every part of Area 2.
Commander, point 48, check complete. Radiation normal. That's it, sir. All okay out here.
All right, Jackson. Thanks. Get out of there as fast as you can.
That seems to prove that the radiation can't hurt within safe limits.
Whatever killed our men was not radiation.
Seems not.
Commander, I've got to get out of here.
All right, Collins. We're leaving soon.
No, no, no! Got to get out!
Stop him! He'll kill us all!
Collins suddenly goes berserk, but after a brief but fierce struggle, is overpowered. On returning to Alpha on the light side of the moon, Koenig asks for the flight records of the dead astronauts.
I checked the flight record as you asked, Commander. Listen to this. There's a 2-minute blank out on the flight recorder over navigation beacon Delta, Area 1.
That's where Collins took us on our way to Area 2. Does he always fly that route?
5 or 6 times a week.
And the probe astronauts?
Made their training flights on the dark side of the moon in that general area regularly.
Commander?
Yes, Sandra?
There's a steep rise in heat level, disposal Area 1. All indications show that the radiation level is normal, but the heat continues to rise.
Heat without radiation, without atomic activity. Put Area 1 on the screen, Paul.
Yes, sir.
Look at that. Lightning, surface fires. Victor, any ideas?
As a matter of fact, yes, John. I've been looking at this monitoring device from the old Area 1. It was used to record the magnetic output of the artificial gravity system out there. When the area was closed down, it had nothing to record. But now, look at it.
A 20-fold increase in the magnetic field.
We've been obsessed with radiation. Wrong. What we are facing is a new effect. Magnetic energy outputs of unprecedented violence, arising from the atomic waste deposited on the dark side of the moon over the years.
Magnetic energy responsible for the flare-up at Area 1.
Magnetic energy causing brain damage and bringing death to 11 men.
The probe astronauts went over there daily, as did Collins in the shuttle.
Then we've all been exposed to it since we've all been to Area 2, and to get there we had to pass over Area 1. There could be a cumulative effect that could...
There's even a bigger problem. Area 1 burnt itself out in a huge magnetic subsurface firestorm. What if the same thing happens in Area 2?
Paul, let's get an eagle out there immediately to monitor magnetic levels.
I won't be responsible for any more men out on the surface in these conditions.
Neither will I. We'll do it by remote control and follow it on the screen.
Radiation normal. Magnetic field zero.
Okay, Paul, she's approaching Area 2. Sit her down. Easy does it. Look, she's going out of control. Blast her out of it, Paul.
No use, Commander. She doesn't respond.
She's going to crash.
Look at the reading. A tremendous magnetic surge.
It could trigger an atomic explosion. Paul, contact Commissioner Simmons on Earth. Emergency code Alpha 1.
Yes, sir.
You were right, Doctor. It was radiation.
Magnetic radiation.
And now we're sitting on the biggest bomb man ever made.
Simmons here. What's the trouble?
The heat rise in Area 1 we reported to you has spread to Area 2, which contains 140 times the amount of waste as Area 1. With quantities like that, there could be a chain reaction.
Well, what's to be done?
We can try to break the pile apart, rip up the rods, destroy the mass. By dispersing it over a wide area, we might prevent that.
Good. Do it.
The first 6 Eagles are moving into the area now, Commander.
All right, Paul. Let's see it on the screen. Uma, I want central computer updated with everything possible. Constantly.
We're getting some of the containers moved. Number 26, dispersed to grid 9.
Dispersed to grid 9.
How does it look, Paul?
We've had navigational failures on 2 of the ships. They've returned for replacement. That means the magnetic field is probably expanding.
Tell the others to increase altitude.
Right. Main mission to all Eagles, increase altitude.
Captain Carter.
Yes, sir.
Carter, do you have an extra ship available?
No, sir, they're all committed.
Then take Eagle 1 into orbit. Report how things look from there.
Right.
Sandra, what are the readings?
Heat level holding, magnetic field fluctuating.
That's what worries me.
What are the chances of getting it under control, Victor?
Too early to tell.
Eagle 1 to Alpha.
Go ahead, 1.
Liftoff complete. Trajectory computed and programmed. We'll be in orbit in 2 minutes.
Okay, Alan. Levels seem to be holding. If only they can...
Commander! It's going up!
Paul, abort the mission.
Main mission to all Eagles. Return to base immediately. Repeat, return to base immediately.
Suddenly, all aboard Alpha Moonbase are hurled to the floor and held there as though pinned down by a huge, invisible hand.
I can't move!
G-forces, we're moving. The moon is moving.
Alpha, can you hear me? This is Carter in Eagle One. Do you copy? Alpha, I'm not receiving. Maybe you're receiving me. The moon is going out of orbit. It's moving away from Earth.
Carter, I read you. Can you hear me?
Commander, thank God you're okay. What's happening down there?
We've got preventive G-forces. We can hardly move. But we seem to be decelerating. Down to 3 Gs now.
Yes, we're compensating. You see, the whole waste disposal area has been acting like a gigantic rocket motor, pushing us out of orbit. But if it has stopped fissioning, we shan't be accelerating anymore.
Carter, did you hear that?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Can you make it back to the base?
Yeah, I can make it. I'm closing now. I can make it.
Good, Captain. Morrow, check around the base.
This is main mission. All sections report.
The Gurney section, we have audio contact. Video system's gone.
Service section lost all power. Operating on emergency systems.
Medical section poor. Explosive decompression in 2 compartments. Area sealed off. No leaks. Sufficiently operative to accept casualties.
The big question now is, can we make it back to Earth? Uma, consult the master computer. I want a readout on contingency plan Exodus.
Yes, sir.
Emergency operation Exodus. Indefinite patterns. 1. Moon on unknown trajectory. 2. Constantly changing G-forces due to movement away from Earth. 3. Insufficient data to compute flight plan. Human decision required.
Attention, all sections, Alpha. This is Commander John Koenig. As you know, the moon has been blasted out of orbit, and we have been completely cut off from Earth. We have power, environment, and therefore the possibility of survival. If we should try to return to Earth without full resources, I believe we would fail. Therefore, it is my judgment we do not try. Paul, what about our communications with Earth? Any chance of restoring contact?
Very little, sir. We've lost all direct communication. All I can get is this video report being broadcast on Earth.
Put it up on the big screen.
The totally unforeseen accident on the lunar surface has caused very serious repercussions here on Earth. Due to gravity disruption, there have been violent earthquakes in the United States, Yugoslavia, and southern France, with enormous damage to life and property. The International Lunar Commission holds out little hope for the rescue of the 311 men and women on Moon Base Alpha. The moon's acceleration away from Earth has put it beyond the reach of any...
Scan all frequencies for any signal from any planet. Paul, there's a picture coming in. There, hold that.
It's the planet Meta.
Meta. Maybe that's where our future lies. September 13th, 1999. Meta signals increasing.
Yes, maybe there.
And that was Space 1999 Breakaway. So, Brian, you're our resident expert. As an adaptation of the episode, what do you think of it? And how do you think it works just as a comic book and an audio adventure?
Well, I think they did a really good job on it. You know, I guess they had to do Breakaway. They just couldn't start somewhere. They needed to give the premise of the show. And Breakaway is not terribly exciting for children. I mean, it has its scenes, and they've kind of boiled it down to being a lot, you know, obviously a lot quicker. It's a Reader's Digest version, but also a lot more exciting. You know, there's lots of things happening. They've cut out some of the more violent things, you know, because you guys have both seen Breakaway. There's a lot of there's a space madness to that virus that they kind of just kind of gloss over. But they do a great job. The thing that always – there's 2 things that strike me really good about this is, one – the art is really faithful to the show, way more faithful than, like, say, the Charlton comics or other things that came out. You know, it really looks like they had a tremendous amount of reference material, save for 2 actors. And the other thing is that the voice artists, particularly the guy doing Victor Bergman, is really trying. He's really trying to capture the actor. And one of the things that always makes me laugh is that that line where he says, "Victor, you're still here." And he says, "Yes, I got caught." That's actually from the show. So they were obviously working with the script. And that guy tries to give it the same inflection. Like, it's almost like he watched the episode and, you know, was kind of doing it. The lady doing the Barbara Bain voice sounds like she's in another room, from what I could tell, at all times. Like, she's in the closet. I don't know what that's about.
Social distance recording.
Yeah, they're really faithful. For some reason, they write out some incidental characters. Commissioner Simmons, who's really kind of like the villain in that episode and in later episodes, isn't quite as big a character, and they draw him to look like Superman, which is really, really weird because, you know, Roy Deutris is the actor who played him, and it's almost like I think that they may have gotten their reference material mixed up because
it's been known to happen with Power Records.
Yeah, well, we joked earlier about Black Sulu and White Uhura. Well, here, I'm almost tempted to believe that they got the reference material of actor Roy Deutris, who played Commissioner Simmons, confused with the actor who played Paul Morrow. They could not look more different. The actor who played Roy Deutris is kind of a thin, frail man, and the guy who played Paul Morrow, his name is going to escape me the entire evening, he is a beefier guy. Prentice Hancock is his name. He's a beefier, more manly, lantern-jawed type fellow. And when I look at the drawings in the book of Paul Morrow, he looks exactly like Commissioner Simmons, Roy Deutris, who was a father on Beauty and the Beast.
Were likeness rights a thing in the 70s?
Nah.
No.
There was Paul Morrow dolls. Paul Morrow is in the comics. He's on the cover of annuals. That is absolutely not an issue.
Okay.
I have so much merchandise with Prentice Hancock's face on it. There's no way he had some sort of Richard Hatch thing going
right,
on.
Okay.
That's just a weird mix-up. And the other one that just kills me is we have a whitewashed Uhura character again in the form of Sandra. I don't think they knew what Sandra looked like, but the actress Xenia Merton is Burmese. And there are three distinct attempts to draw Sandra. And I'll talk more about it in return at the beginning. But in this one, she kind of looks like Betty Crocker. And I think at one point, Koenig refers to a staff member as Uma, and I don't think that's a character on the show. I don't know if they had an early script. Oh, no, Ben Uma. Okay, no, he was. Oh, God. All right, I'm wrong. So obscure a character that I don't actually remember this guy.
Wow.
Oh, that's why. Okay. I just had to look up the catacombs because I'm not perfect, but the computer expert in the series was named David Kano, but I guess in the first episode, it's a guy by the name of Ben Uma. Basically, they're the same sort of character, but it's obvious that they just kind of retooled them for the series.
I wondered if they just didn't, in terms of the likenesses, whether they realized, well, we want it to look like Martin Landau, we want it to look like Barbara Bain, Barry Morse, but for these other characters, we don't care. So just draw whatever you want.
It's hard to say because the Alan Carter, of course, would be like the fourth name on the show. He's in most of the episodes, and it's a pretty generic Nick Tate, but it's not bad. It looks like him. There's not the amount of concern that goes into Lando or Bane or Morse, but at least, like, yeah, I get it. That's supposed to be Alan Carter. You know, he's the right color, you know.
Chris, what's your best guess as to who drew this? Because to me, it looks a little Dick Giordano-ish, but then other places, no, not so much.
Well, I looked it up. I guessed it was Russ Heath, and I looked up Russ Heath Space 1999, and a Heritage auction from last year came up for this cover.
Oh,
and it
there you
credited
go.
Russ Heath. Yeah, it credited Russ Heath. And I think he drew both of these. And it was probably done through Continuity Studios. So Dick Giordano may have inked it, or, you know, the many hands of the Continuity Studios, Larry Hama or Terry Austin or whoever was, you know, walking through the office that day, probably inked a page or a figure here and there.
Right.
It's got that continuity look, but
those things were a bit of a mashup then.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times even famously, you know, not to mow Rob's grass, but famously Neil Adams, you know, touched up some artwork in the Superman, Spider-Man Treasury book over Ross Andrew, mm-hmm. you know? So it's definitely that many hand situation, but I guess this kind of looks like Russ Heath, and I was just like typed it in and it came up. Oh wow, it's Russ Heath apparently. This looks fantastic. I mean, it just looks great. And I gotta say, man, their spacesuits are like so cool. I love the spacesuits on this show.
Oh yeah, the orange, those are so eye popping and colorful, and it's got a. In terms of design, it's really hard to top Space 1999. It really had this amazing look. And it's really funny because the fellow who did the Space 1999 designs, I know his first name was Keith, but the last name's evading me. I was watching a TV show. There's a British TV show called Star Maidens. And it really looks like an episode of Space 1999. The sound effects, the look of the spaceships. And you keep waiting for Moonbase Alpha to show up, but it's not my favorite show. Keith Wilson's his name. And it turns out, Keith Wilson's designed that show during the hiatus of Space 1999.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, wow, does he have a style? You know, like, it's just so obvious.
I tell you, one thing I noticed, too, is I feel like from watching the show, I feel like they got some Star Trek the Motion Picture owes some inspiration to this, just the colors of the uniforms the fit of them and things like that. I mean, it just feels like TMP in a lot of ways, you know. It just
I never thought about that.
Yeah, it just, to me, it does. I mean, I guess coming from a place of, you know, classic movie, classic TV show Trek and then TMP, this is kind of the in between those two, and it just maybe I could be wrong, but I just feel like they kind of, you know, it's a snake eating its own tail in that regard. So
yeah, you're probably right. I mean, I think I've read that the Star Trek the Motion Picture uniforms were the way they were because of somebody saying that they didn't feel the TV uniforms looked realistic on the big screen.
Mm.
So I actually. The first season uniforms, they're designed, I think, by Rudy Gernreich, who was a famous fashion designer at the time. And I do love about season two the little tweaks they gave them. You know, they gave people jackets and vests, and it kind of broke up the monotony. So they kind of went more Star Trek in the second season. They gave them a lot of blues and reds as opposed to this kind of like... I guess you call it a tan for everybody.
What, Chris, as someone who is not a expert or not really familiar at all with Space 1999, what do you think of it as a power record?
You know, I think they did a great job adapting it into that episode. Because, you know, I just watched this episode and then turned around and listened to the adaptation. I agree with Brian. They boiled it down really well. And I think the voice cast is great. I think I recognize some voices like Commander Koning is Kirk Langstrom from Robin Meets Man Bat. My beloved Robin Meets Man Bat.
I haven't gotten to the point where I recognize voices. I hope to get there someday.
I have that one seared into my brain. So when I hear that guy talk, it's I instantly recognize it. And I think Bergman is the guy that was Sherlock Holmes in the Batman power record as well. Same album for me. So the Mystery of the Scarecrow Corpse. I thought the sound quality was, the sounds were great. The only thing that was kind of weird was when Koenig does his speech at the end. There's like this, the music kind of sounds like a South Seas Romance.
And then it kind of, doesn't it kind of just like swell up and disappear like it's over? I find it's a real, like, the end. And it's like, yeah, okay, I know that's how that ends, but wow, it was quick, you know?
Yeah, it's like comes out of nowhere, and it's like, wait a minute, I'm, you know, expecting palm trees and, you know, waves crashing against the beach.
And if you forget that it's for children and that, you know, they're totally fine with the people, oh, God, we're escaping Earth. Well, we'll try this planet. Like, they're just, you know. But, yeah, I forgot about that music.
It does remind me a little bit of the Planet of the Apes records in that they just cut out all the character stuff and just hit the action beats because, of course, like you said, it's a Reader's Digest version. It's aimed at children, so they have to just really get to it. You know, so it's the splash page is the big explosion. There's a full page shot of the mushroom cloud. I mean, and there's a big fist fight at one point. So yeah, a lot of the talkity talk is all removed just so they can have a lot more action beats. But again, they've got to tell the whole story in like 24 pages. So, I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. I will say, on the art front, I really like the back cover of this thing. And it's the three main actors, and it's all in black and white, which is very unusual for Power Records. And it's got them in profile, and it says Journey Through the Universe with the Crew of Moonbase Alpha, and there's more stuff about Space 99. And it's all in black and white in front of this starfield. And even the Power Records logo is in black and white. Which I thought was a really nice little touch.
It is really nice, and it is the only
Power Records
series recommended by a former member of the Nazi Party. That I know of.
Space 1999 has received a recommended viewing commendation from Dr. Wernher von Braun, president of the National Space Institute. So there you go.
Hitler's rocket guy.
Ooh. Yikes.
Okay, so why don't we move on?
Yeah.
Why don't we move on? No, the next story we're going to do is an all-original Space 1999 story. It's very unusual for what they would do on the show. We'll talk about that on the other side of it. So let's get right to it, everybody. Next up is Space 1999, Return to the Beginning.
Day on Moonbase Alpha, as Earth's great satellite, blasted out of orbit by a tremendous explosion of nuclear waste materials, moved through space on its journey into the unknown. Suddenly, a deep rumbling shatters the comm, and Alpha shakes and vibrates as though in the grip of a giant hand. In main mission, Commander John Koenig barks out commands.
Sandra, all scanners and sensors up full.
Yes, sir.
Connell, computer report as fast as you can get it.
Right, Commander.
Paul, activate big screen.
Yes, sir.
What's happening, John? I don't know, Victor, but the way this place is shaking, we'd better find out fast.
Commander, on the big screen, look.
Phew. If I didn't know better, I'd swear we were in the middle of a terrestrial hurricane.
All that debris out there, like a cosmic minefield.
Commander, computer reports radiation level at danger point and rising.
Paul, activate radiation and meteorite defense screens. We're going to red alert. Seal all bulkheads. Damage units and medical, stand by.
The storm builds to a ferocious climax, with sound levels beyond the limits of human endurance. And suddenly, all personnel black out and fall to the floor, oblivious to the fury raging around them. And then, just as suddenly, it is over. And one by one, they revive as the moon emerges from the turbulence.
Sandra, get damage reports from all sections. Paul, do we have power?
I think so, sir. Yes, we do.
Good. Activate big screen. Well, we're in the clear, at least.
Commander, no major damage reported, just a few minor injuries.
That's a help. Victor, what do you think that was all about?
According to the navigation charts, there should have been no stars or planets or any concentrations of matter in this area. Nothing but empty space.
Then how do you explain all that debris we passed through?
The only conclusion I can reach is that we have come through a black hole in space.
A black hole? But wouldn't that have drawn us into a dying star and incinerated us?
Not if we passed through the outer fringes only and came within the gravitation field of another star, which...
Commander, a new contact.
Paul, bring it in on the big screen. A planet. A big one. Connell, computer readout.
Diameter 7926 miles at equator. Atmosphere breathable. Cloud cover H2O. surface temperatures compatible with human existence.
John, look at that cloud cover, broken by patches of blue. The general configuration, could it possibly be...
Commander, I get life signs.
Commander, I don't believe it. That planet, it's ours.
There's no mistake, John, it is. It's the Earth.
The Earth? Oh, we're home!
Oh, hey,
like the Earth, but there's something strange about all this. Alan, get Eagle One ready. We're going down and take a closer look. Within the hour, Eagle One is headed toward the planet with a landing party headed by John Cook. Still no response to our call, Helena?
No, John, nothing.
Strange. They didn't answer our calls from main mission either. Every instrument reading and visual sighting confirms that this is our Earth. But we get no radio communication or any other sign of the civilization we knew.
But we do get unmistakable life signs.
Cloud cover very heavy, Commander. But there's a break right over there at 3 o'clock. Looks like a good landing area below it.
Time we got some answers. Set her down, Alan.
Landing on a hilltop on the surface, they step out of the Eagle, leaving Alan inside, and find themselves overlooking a veritable Garden of Eden. Green valleys and cool waters ringed in by a circle of mountains that shut out a hostile, unseen world beyond.
And look, John, shepherds tending their flock. Women carrying water from the well. Look at the robes they're wearing. It's as though we...
Yeah, I know. As though we had stepped back thousands of years in time.
I think that's exactly what we have done, John.
What do you mean?
According to computer readings I made on board Alpha, and every calculation I've come up with since, we are back at or near the beginning of time. The Old Testament year, 3347 B.C.
Ridiculous, Victor. There must be some mistake. Maybe the storm threw the computer off kilter.
No mistake, John. Somehow we must have passed through a time warp in space when we passed through the black hole. We have returned to the Earth of biblical times.
Incredible. Koenig here. What's up, Alan?
Our onboard instrumentation seems to have gone haywire, Commander.
What's wrong?
Computer says it's the year 3347 B.C.
Computer is right, Alan.
You're kidding, Commander.
It's no joke, Alan. Keep an eye on the instrument readings and let us know if anything else unusual shows up. We're going down into the land of Canaan.
They certainly seem to be a happy, carefree lot.
I wonder if this is a celebration day of some kind, or do they always live it up like this? Victor, how's your knowledge of the language?
Fortunately, I've brought along something I've been working on for years. I call it the Commulator.
Looks like a modified Comlock.
Exactly. I've built in a miniature computer which is programmed not only to translate what is said to us, but translate what we say into any language instantaneously.
Look, that bearded old man haranguing the crowd over there. Let's see if we can understand him.
You have sinned in the eyes of the Lord. If you do not turn away from the path of evil and repent, then will he surely destroy you.
It works. We can understand everything.
Go tell it to the sheep and camels and the elephants, you crazy old coot. Maybe you'll get them to repent.
The Lord will send down rain for 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing will be destroyed.
It hasn't rained for 6 months, and there's not a cloud to be seen in the sky.
Sinners, blasphemers, you have been warned. I can do no more.
Yes, you can. You and your sons can go sail your crazy boat up over the mountaintop.
Good Lord. You know who that old man is? It's Noah.
And the boat the young man mentioned, it must be the Ark.
He was right about one thing, though. The weather seems to be perfect.
But as crazy as it sounds, if that is Noah, then we know how the story ended. I wonder, is the Earth going to get a second chance? What's that rumbling? Alan, give me seismograph reading.
Seismograph indicates deep subterranean turbulence about 1,000 miles from this location, with a reading of 9.9 on the Richter scale. And Commander, the barometer is falling faster than I've ever seen before.
Run the figures through the computer, Alan, and give me a readout.
Okay, here it comes. Earthquake potential maximum. Tidal wave probability 99%. Cloud cover now encompassing rest of Earth will close in over this area. Conclusion, cataclysmic earthquake activity combined with cloudburst and tidal wave will create flood conditions engulfing whole planet. Commander, we gotta get out of here.
I've got to try to warn the people first, Alan. Stand by.
What are you going to do, John?
Watch me.
grabbing the commulator out of Victor's hands, he runs to the platform where Noah had been standing and shouts to the people.
Listen to me, everyone, listen. You are in extreme danger. There is going to be a flood. You will all be drowned unless you go up to the mountains now.
Don't listen to that stranger. He's as crazy as old Noah. Just look at the crazy way he's dressed.
But I can prove what I say. I have scientific evidence.
Come on, John. It's no use. They won't listen to you any more than they listen to Noah.
What a frustrating feeling to know the tragedy about to happen and not to be able to do a thing about it.
How can you change history that has already been recorded?
Yeah, I guess you're right. Let's get back to the Eagle.
They reach the Eagle, look back one last time, and climb in just as a tremendous rumbling shakes the earth and ominous clouds close in.
Hurry, Commander!
Okay, Alan, take her up.
A couple of minutes more, we never would have made it off the ground, Commander.
Yeah, I know. Give it everything, Alan. Eagle 1 calling main mission. Eagle 1 calling main mission. Do you copy?
Main mission. Got you, Eagle 1. You had us worried.
Paul, what readings do you get on the planet?
Visual sighting 0. Seismograph and barometric readings indicate extreme turbulence on planet's surface. Unable to get life sign readings. Commander, can anyone survive through all that?
From personal observation, we can't answer that. But feel that at least one man and his family have a chance.
What about us, Commander? Will we be going home?
No way, Paul. Given our moon's trajectory, the Earth will be far beyond Eagle range at the end of the 40 days and 40 nights that storm is going to last.
40 days and 40 nights? Where did you get those figures, Commander? Not even our main computer banks can predict that accurately.
Just read the Bible, Paul. Read the Bible.
A few days later, in main mission.
It was an extraordinary experience, John.
But heartbreaking to be so close, and yet so far.
Commander?
Yes, Sandra?
Computer, it's going berserk. Look.
The date readings. Years clicking past like seconds.
It started at 3347 BC, but look at it.
It stopped. The year is 2002 AD, where we were before the whole thing began. Victor, any explanation?
Well, I can just give you an educated guess. As we traveled farther and farther away from the area of the black hole, we may have returned through the time warp in space into our own era.
Or were we all just the victims of a mass hallucination brought on by the mind-twisting forces set loose in the pressures of a space storm?
We may never know, but whatever it was good to have been home again, even if just for a few hours.
And that was Space 1999, Return to the Beginning, as I mentioned, an all-original Space 1999 adventure. Brian, what do you think of this one as an all-original effort?
Well, I'm sure glad they didn't go to an alien planet and do something interesting. I've always hated this record. I've always hated it. It's gorgeous. It's well-acted. It is weird. They didn't create an original story like Star Trek or, you know, they didn't adapt a script that they had, you know, they would have had with another episode. Like, I would have preferred even Earthbound or something like that. No, they go right back to Earth. They go back to Bible times. They do nothing and leave. And I just find it such a weird, were they trying to get the religious market into this? Maybe that was it. I'm not sure, but I just find it one of the strangest power records I own. And I own the one where the clown shoots himself, and you know, and it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. You know, that the cover is excellent. It's amazing.
I love the cover.
You know? Yeah, it's so visual and beautiful, and you know, it's just like, you know, and I'm glad I own it. But I remember the first time I cracked this open and played it, and I was like, what was that? You know? And then, I mean, they went back to Earth on Space 1999, the show, too. But at least they ended up, like, getting the plague and stuff. Like, there was all kinds of, like, you know, conflict. And this is just a very odd choice. And it's never been my favorite thing, the piece of merchandise, even though I think it looks amazing.
I wonder why they did this. I mean, why they had episodes. I mean, I know a lot of the Star Treks were original, and they did some Planet of the Apes original stories, but I wonder why.
Yes,
I mean,
they did.
Yeah.
No. It's just a quizzical thing. I guess they were trying to be deep, but it's just sort of like, you know, like I think of like the Star Trek ones, the Crier in the Emptiness, or the one with the cat,
Passage to Muav, I believe that's
Passage to Muav. And I listened to those a million times as a kid, and I thought they were great. And so they definitely had the chops to write something that was interesting, but they, you know, I also want to point out something that I find really ridiculously funny on this is that they go down to, I don't know where they are, but just Bible land. And Victor Bergman pulls out, he goes, "This is a commulator." And he goes, "It'll translate any language we say instantaneously." And it's like, you know, the series didn't ever account for that once. You know, they went to like a million planets and everyone spoke English with a British accent and nobody questioned it. But a child's Power Records is like, well, we've got to explain this. Bible times that they could speak to these people. And I was like, well, that's one for Power Records, you know.
This story always feels like a sort of weirded, warmed over Star Trek adventure, in that it's like you've got them going back into Bible times and it's like, well, the prime directive, we have to make sure that we don't like change anything. Although, of course, they're walking around in their spacesuits. So, I mean, I guess they're not worried about it.
They're walking around in their spacesuits, and then Lando takes Koenig takes the stage. You know, and says, "I have scientific evidence," you know, which doesn't even work now. And let alone back then, you know. But the best panel in this for me is there's a panel towards the end. I think it's page 15 where, like, Bergman is holding Koenig by his arm and Koenig's got his fist balled up. You know, he's frustrating to know the tragedy. He could, you know, and it's just, it's so like, this is so not Space Knight. Like that just, what's he going to do? Fight that crowd? That's not Commander Koenig. You know, he's not a Captain Kirk. And to, you know, Lando's credit, he never made Koenig Captain Kirk. You know, he wasn't a man of action. He was, you know, a C-plus fighter at best on the show. And they never made a big deal about that. But yeah, I just find it an odd story. Like, basically, they go down. So now they know God exists and stuff, or the Bible was true. Like, wouldn't that be the discussion on the way back to Alpha? Like, what the hell did we just see? Yeah, and he actually says, "Just read the Bible, Paul. Read the Bible." And it's like, no, this doesn't belong in Space 1999. They go into like God's brain in an episode, you know, and then they go through the Black Sun.
What does God need with a starship?
Yeah. No, but I mean, the show, I think it's trying to be metaphysical, and it's just kind of like metaphysical for a child's record, you know, like. I've always found it a bit of an odd choice.
The thing about this that got me, it's like, one, I had two thoughts. One, okay, I feel like when I was a kid and I bought the Archie comic at the grocery store, and I'm like, oh, cool, I'll get me an Archie comic. And then I get it home and Archie starts preaching to me, and I look on the cover and it's like, what the crap's an Archie Spire comic?
Why is Archie praying?
Right. Why is Archie praying for Reggie? You know, it's like, you know, and it's like, you know, and for, you know, to Jughead or something. And then, you know, so I feel like this is like the Spire version of a Power Record. You know, it's like it's some
in a way. Like, yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. And it's an interesting, like, they could have just done an Archie Spire Power Record. My daughter, by the way, collects Spire Christian comics. She loves Christian Archies.
She got the amazing. Barney the Bear comics too from Spire.
No, you know the ones I got her a stack one day at an antique mall, and they were the biographies.
Oh, okay.
And she's like, "Dad, these aren't fun. These are kind of good." Like, can you get me? Because like, I don't. The biography ones are actually just somebody's biography, and they're not actually that bad. And the Archies are just like, they're terrible. Like, I can't stand Al Hartley's art. They're not funny. And then I guess whatever the Goldwater group said, they really can't be super religious either. So they're just kind of gently religious, you know, like they're, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, but it's just a weird mishmash. So where you're like, what am I reading? You know? And I remember that I went to a kid's house when I was like a little, you know, oh, you've got comics. And it was like, oh, your comics are weird. And they were all Spire. Like, it took me about 20 minutes
My other point with this is that, you know, the cover makes me think, we mentioned the Savage Curtain. We're in like a space leaking type situation.
Yeah.
There's no floating in space. It's like, why? I thought they were going to team up. I thought the Alpha Base crew was going to be on the Ark with him or something, you know, and it was actually going to, they were actually going to make it fly or something. That's what I was expecting. And it's like, nothing happens. I mean, really, literally, nothing happens in this thing.
Better power record than we have here. I want to read that one. Yeah, you're right. There, nothing changes. It's just like they get to witness.
And not even the really exciting part. They witness it right before it gets exciting, and they leave.
And they just get the heck out of Dodge.
Yeah. But the comic looks great and it sounds great, so, you know.
Yeah, it is beautiful. It's just so well drawn. And in fact, in certain parts, it looks like they took photo stats of Moonbase Alpha, like pictures of it, and just colored them.
Mm.
Because I think it is a terribly complicated thing to draw.
Yeah, I'd say so. I can't imagine drawing that over and over again, especially, yeah.
I even like the one little kind of piece of good girl art where the one character, the woman who saw, I forget the name of the character, where she's like, I've got a signal coming in, and it's just it's her in profile with like her bust kind of in profile. I was like, that's just a really kind of sexy drawing.
Yeah, except they call her Sandra. And then later on, Sandra is drawn differently in the back. She's back to being Betty Crocker, but she's this like curvaceous redhead for the first like 3-4 pages.
Yes.
It's like they forgot who they were drawing. Yeah, and that's the weirdest thing. And that's another, like, again, this is a petite Burmese lady, not a, you know, not Christina Hendricks that's on page 6. And, I find that more funny than anything. You know, it's just. I think the Uhura one bugs me more because it's like, didn't you guys ever see this show?
You know? Yeah. Pretty important character there.
Yeah. Like Sandra, I get. Okay, not everybody knows who Sandra is, but like, that's Uhura, man.
So obviously, Power Records had a lot of faith in this franchise because. As I was working on this blog, I over the years in the early 2000s, I learned that, you know, outside of the two book and record sets, and these are the only two book and record sets that Power Records ever did, but they did two other long form LPs of Space 1999 with other adventures, with other audio adventures.
With actually, and Chris, this is a good episode to look up. They actually adapted Mission of the Darians, which is one of my favorites as well. And I think they even went deep into the second season. I think there's even I have the Maya. Now I have to look, but I think they actually did an adaptation of the second season too.
Yeah, one LP features Breakaway, Death's Other Dominion, and Mission of the Darians. And then the other one is called Space 1999, The Future is Fantastic. And
that's a second season cover, yeah.
Return to the Beginning, End of Eternity, Dragon's Domain, and If Played So Softly on the Ear. And boy, the cover to that one makes the show look like Star Trek. I mean, it makes it look like Star Trek crossed with Buck Rogers. I mean,
Welcome to the second season.
Oh, man, does it look fun. I mean, I really can't, you know, like, they look really cool.
Well, The Future is Fantastic was actually the second season tagline.
And that's great.
What Power Records has done basically is taken the second season I guess, promotional book and kind of put a cover on it. But unfortunately, it is just like when young Brian went and bought a cover that had Star Trek the Motion Picture on it, and then the inside was Star Trek the Original Series, which turned out to be pretty good anyways. But they didn't – yeah, that's just, it's definitely like – I'd say they probably did that in 77, and it was to cash in on the new look of the series. But there's no, like, I don't think Maya appears in any of it. So it's still just, like, those, all those stories, End of Eternity. Wow, they did End of Eternity. God, and they did Dragon's Domain. End of Eternity is a really dark episode. Also a good one, Chris. And Return to the Beginning. Oh, yeah, of course, Return to the Beginning. We got our Noah again. Boy, they really chose some dark ones. Mission of the Daryans is dark. Death's Utter Dominion is clearly very dark. Wow. I don't know what it played so softly on the air. That may be the one original drama they did. You know, I own this record, but I don't think I've ever listened to it all the way through.
Well, that sounds like a teaser for you to come back to the show at some point, Brian.
I would hate that.
So
I got to say, if they did Death's Utter Dominion as an adaptation, I wish they'd done a comic, because I was watching that and I'm saying, oh, there's Brian Blessed. That's awesome. But then yeah. I'm like, wait a minute. In the background, I recognize that really, really attractive lady in the background. I'm like, is that Valerie Leon from Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, Blood from the Mummy's Tomb? And I'm like,
of course it is.
And I looked it up and I'm like, yeah, it's her. And I'm like, I knew it was her, but I'm like, wow, it's like, and she has no lines and isn't credited. I mean, my God, that woman, they should, like, put her before Martin Landau when she walks on.
Yeah. Well, that is the other thing about Space 1999 is if you're a Hammer fan or a fan of, you know, Amicus films, you're going to see a lot of familiar faces and, you know, a lot of, like, really beautiful faces as well.
Whew. Okay, I need a moment. Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, that's a perfect place to stop our talk on Space 1999. Brian, you will have to come back for the second episode where we cover the other stories, because they sound like just as much fun, if not more, than these two that we've talked about. So, all right, well, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on the internet?
Oh, okay. You can find me at several different – I'm all over the place. On YouTube, I have a channel called Brick Mantooth, where I talk about old toys, and I have a podcast. On, you know, Facebook, I have the Plaid Stallions page. We have the MIGO Museum page, which is all about MIGO toys. We have a Pod Stallions, which is our podcast. And I know I'm selling it like it's awesome. But, you know, we have all these different – I don't sleep much. So I do a lot of different stuff. So I'm at plaidstallions.com, migomuseum.com. And currently I am launching my first of what I hope is many print magazines called Toy Ventures, which is based off my YouTube series. And it is currently at the printer. And I'm very nervous.
That's exciting, though. Yeah, that's cool, man.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Trust me, I am too. I can't wait to get it's during COVID. I started the magazine as a preoccupation kind of thing. Like, this will keep my head out of every other thing, you know, out of Facebook, and it turned into this wonderful labor of love where all these people. It was like an Amish person a virtual Amish person trying to build a barn, and all these other people came and helped me, and. I had so many wonderful offers of help that I want to continue and go on with additional issues and get, you know, more input and have more fun with it. But I'm just trying to make a magazine like I would read. So hopefully I can find 2,000 other people that are like me.
Well, you've got at least two right here, I'm sure.
That's yay! Right. So just 1997 left. Yeah, I'm not worried. Yeah. I've spoken to dozens of other magazine publishers who publish niche things that are very, you know, not in any way similar to mine, but, you know, in that same kind of vein. And they say business is fantastic.
Oh, good. That's good news.
Know, appealing to a niche and is one guy I talked to said my sales have never been better.
Wow.
And it's like, wow. Okay.
That's awesome.
That is really cool. The future's fantastic, Brian.
It is. It absolutely is. And I hope bell bottoms make a big comeback.
Me too. Well, anyway, thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, it's
Chris,
a pleasure, guys.
Yeah, Chris and I have been wanting to do this one forever, and we said it was just a matter of getting you on the show, and so we're so glad you had a chance to sit down and talk with you again.
These are, despite even what I say of a return to the beginning, these are absolute favorites of mine.
All right, everybody. Well, stay tuned. We're going to play some podcast promos. And on the other side, Chris and I will be back to do some listener feedback.
Greetings, podcast listener. My name is Charlie Niemeyer, and I host a show called Charlie's Geekcast, all about me and what I like. But mostly about what I like. 2020 marks a pretty special year for me. For one thing, I'll be turning 40 this year. But this year also marks 10 years since I started podcasting by talking about Superman's adventures in the Bronze Age. Coincidentally, this year also marks 50 years since Superman entered the Bronze Age. To celebrate all of this year I'll be doing a series of episodes called Geeking on Superman in the Bronze Age, where I'll be looking at some great Bronze Age Superman adventures that I didn't get around to the first time around. It's a lot of around. So check out Charlie's Geekcast, part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network at twotruefreaks.com. Also, you can find the show at charliesgeekcast.com or wherever you get your podcast.
Space, the final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Give Me That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Give Me That Star Trek. A new episode every month, only at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
And we're back. And as promised, we're going to do listener feedback for the previous episode of the Power Rockets podcast, which was episode 24, Man-Bat and the Riddler. And we're going to be reading the comments we got from the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. So, Chris, why don't you start us off?
My Nightcast partner, Ryan Daly, who knows a thing or two about Batman, wrote in to say, I, too, love the classic Man-Bat stories, and I got such a thrill out of how the original trilogy of issues were sewn together for this tale. And as you guys were discussing, I started to think the next villain I want to see in a Batman movie is Man-Bat, followed by the Mad Hatter. And then you guys said the same thing 5 seconds later. We've all been around each other too much.
I think we're all just cross-pollinating each other's ideas. But, yeah, seconded to both those things, or thirded, since I already said it in the previous episode, that would be super cool. I would love to see that. So, little Russell Burbage from our website, he says, a great review show, guys. I love Man-Bat, and I love this book and record set. It's not the only one I bought as a kid, but it's the only one I kept and still have to this day. I didn't get any of the non-book 45s or LPs, so I never heard of this Riddler story. I agree, it's pretty damn good. Thanks for providing it for our listening pleasure. Well, you're welcome, Russell. Matt Sorois says, yay, another episode of Power Records, and featuring two of the best stories they've ever done. I don't care if you've covered them before. It's great to hear them again and get both Rob and Chris's opinions and memories related to them. Plus, now they're in the same feed as the other Power Records. Yes, Matt, that was exactly my idea. The only downside, we have run out of Batman. Oh, well, plenty of other great characters to listen to. Anyways, there is one question that remains about the Riddler adventure. Just what in the great Gotham does If Music Be the Food of Death even mean? Even the world's greatest detective can't solve that one. Matt Sirius, proud member of the Shag Matthews crap list. That's a long list, Matt.
Paul Waldenberger commented, and he said, Chris, I hear what you mean about Commissioner Gordon sounding like the magician from Frosty the Snowman. They have very similar voice and vocal inflections. The actor in Frosty is Billy D. Wolfe, but I don't believe it was him. This Power record was released a year after he passed away in 1973. It is possible this was recorded long before it came out, but I doubt it. Yeah, it probably wasn't him, but there's something about him that made me think of Metsy, that guy, you know, that just popped in my head.
Gotham's Mansion says, If Music Be the Food of Death is a play on If Music Be the Food of Love, play on, from Shakespeare's play Twelfth Night. I read the play in college and realized, oh, that is where the Power Records title came from. I hope I don't seem like a know-it-all pointing that out, but Matt did ask. Just FYI, there is a 70s drive-in sex comedy version of Twelfth Night, which I saw in Joe Bob Briggs' drive-in theater.
I Perfect had the, for you and Max.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, we got to cover that. I got to find that one. I had the albums of these before I got the book and record of Man Bat. Did anyone think it was weird that Robin was in all four stories that had the villain's cover, but Robin himself was nowhere to be found on the cover? On the album that had Batman and Robin running on the beach, Robin is on the cover, but only appears on one story. The image of Robin was lifted and used on one of those wooden kids' puzzles. I don't know if a Batman picture disc would have been a good idea. I might have been hypnotized. I might have hypnotized myself staring at it as it went around the turntable. That's a pretty deep reference for them to write Shakespeare on a Power record. That's pretty impressive.
Right. Yeah. I guess, you know, I mean, that's one thing we got to give Power Records credit for. They definitely didn't dumb down their stories for kids.
No.
You know, I mean, if it sent the kid, you know, I mean, you know, if the kid, you know, like, actually, you know, this Space 1999 might have actually sent some kids, you know, back to their Bibles or something to look stuff up or something, you know, or to look up, you know, some Shakespeare reference. And, you know, it, much like the comics at the time, you know, Stan Lee always said he didn't dumb down the language. He'd throw in words and send kids to their dictionaries. So, you know, I think it's cool that kids read up when they were reading along with the Power Records. So that's cool. The hypnotized, as far as the hypnotized angle, I remember some of the Power Records Batman, they had Batman swinging on, they had his Batman logo and his swinging on the label of the album. Mm-hmm. And when you watch it turn, it looks like, it really does look like Batman's like swinging around in circles around
them. It does, yes.
So it kind of does do that. It can, I remember kind of just kind of staring at that as a kid, which might explain what happened to me in life, but I don't know. Gothos continues on and says, sorry to drone on so long, but have you guys ever covered the Scarecrow's Mirage? I didn't see it when I looked back through the episodes. Actually, we have not. So we do have one more Batman story to do. We got that one mixed up with the mystery of the Scarecrow corpse, I believe.
Yep.
So
yep.
The Scarecrow's Mirage actually has the Scarecrow, Jonathan Crane. So right. We'll have to get to that one.
Absolutely. He's one of my favorite. He might even be my single favorite Batman villain. I can't believe we haven't gotten to it at this point, and that I overlooked it when we were talking about it on the previous episode. So, yeah, we'll absolutely get to that one sooner rather than later. Edo Boznar says, oh, yeah, this is the stuff. As I mentioned in the comments to an earlier episode, I received Robin Meets Man-Bat together with Hollow Man as a Christmas present. I really loved it because the booklet had that fantastic Neil Adams art. And, yes, at that point, I was already recognizing the styles and names of individual artists. The Riddler story is really surprisingly good. I'm impressed that it's not based on an actual comic book, as Rob noted. It would have been such a great comic. And the Gorshin-esque characterization for the Riddler is a nice touch, because honestly, there was no better villain on the TV show than Gorshin's Riddler. Do you agree with that assessment, Chris?
Yeah, I agree. There's a lot of other ones I love. I love all the main guys for one reason or another, and characters like, you know, I like David Wayne's Mad Hatter. But yeah, Gorshin's Riddler is the tops.
And, of course, you wrote about an episode of the Batman TV series featuring Gorshin's Riddler in the most recent book by Jim Beard about the Batman TV show. Why don't you plug that again while we're here?
Oh, yeah, that's Zlonk Zok Zowie, the Blue Grotto Subterranean Guide to Batman 66, Volume 1. I might have got some of those words in the wrong order, but look up Jim Beard's Zlonk Zok Zowie, and you'll find the book. And, yes, it's I wrote one of the essays on one of the Riddler episodes, Ring of Wax and Give Him the Axe. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. And actually, I've already turned in my essay for volume two. So be on the lookout for that. Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Brian Washington says, regarding the voice actors, I can only identify two, both in the story Robin Meets Man-Bat. Mike McNally, voice of Mitch, one of the bank robbers, and Elliot Lewis. Lewis narrated all four stories in the second Batman album and voiced Kirk Langstrom here. The Riddler story, If Music Be the Food of Death, was written by Joan Wiley, who performed on several children's albums, including Peter Pan's Activity LP, Singing in the Rain, from 1972, and Golden Records' Songs from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, 1968. I believe she was also one of the two story readers for the Peter Pan read-alongs circa 1968. I have the entire collection of 70s-era Power Records, and that's all the Batman stories they have produced, aside from the Christmas album. There was one other Peter Pan picture disc in the series, which was Puff the Magic Dragon, 1982, with some gorgeous artwork by George Peede. And for the record, pun intended, Peter Pan did produce its version of the story Treasure Island in 1950 and was later repurposed into a 45 read-along in 1976. It really doesn't – I really am confounded as why you wouldn't do superhero picture discs when you would do one for Puff the Magic Dragon and Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, I don't either, unless there was some weird kind of – they did not have the license for that in their – licensing, but it's just, yeah, it's really strange. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense.
Can you imagine Neil Adams' Batman picture disc? How gorgeous that would be. Oh, man. David Ace Gutierrez says, dudes, I can't tell you how many times I tried to work, because they're both Russian, in a conversation when I was a kid, I didn't have many friends. So, John Schaefer Hames says, this record was the first comic book related thing in print I ever held in my hands. I checked this out from the library and listened to it repeatedly one summer until my mom finally had it with the shrieking mixed with numerous skips on the record. I still remember Robin and I prefer fighting without guns, without guns, without guns. I now picture the folks editing the thing going, this sounds good, but is there any way we can make Man-Bat shriek more ear-piercingly painful? Okay, good. And how about we make the sonic weapon actually hurt people's ears?
I think John and my parents must have got together at some point, because these are pretty much the same things they said about that record, too. Mm-hmm. So, oh, that's awesome. Mike Bridges commented, very cool to hear these, as I don't remember hearing them as a kid. I agree, would be great to find a Batman or Spider-Man picture disc, but I think by the time Peter Pan was making those, they were targeted towards younger audiences. I just found another PP picture disc and a Peter Pan Empire Strikes Back music album with some lame cover art. I wonder if that was like officially licensed or not. That might
that
be one of those.
That doesn't sound official, right? Yeah.
No, because I think Disney, oddly enough, Disney released all the kids' Star Wars albums, like book and record sets, and on their Disneyland label, if I remember right.
Yeah.
Which, you know, presages them owning Star Wars.
Yeah,
but,
right. That sounds a little dodgy, Power Records. Bruce Wayne Weaver says, I adore these stories. Really brings back floodwaters of childhood memories. I wore out the Riddler story on the LP to the point of maximum warpage. Rebought this record at least twice more since then. As ever, y'all present these classic stories in such glory. Your insight and backstories are full of significant information, and we can hear the love y'all have for them. Thanks for the hours of enjoyment and nostalgia y'all provided. I'm eagerly awaiting the next episode. Maybe it will be Kojak this time. Hint, hint. Keep up the fantastic work. Well, sorry, Bruce. It wasn't Kojak. It's probably about as far away from Kojak as we could get. But we will get to Kojak at some point.
Yeah, I mean, Kojak's one that's actually people have asked us about, too. I think now that we've done Space 1999, I think Kojak might be the most requested one. So
yep. We have a diverse audience.
Yeah. Matt Ludwig says, the Batman meets Man-Bat story was repurposed on a cassette format. It also had the other three stories commented upon by Chris Franklin on the show. I got most of my Power Record stories in cassette format. The other cassettes that came to mind is the Star Trek-based stories. So it's cool. That means, you know, remember I brought the whole the Spider-Man, the Invasion of the Dragon Men, I still have a cassette of that. So we know that later on they went from calling it book and records to book and recordings. Mm-hmm. And so now I didn't know Robin Meets Man-Bat actually ever made it onto a tape. I think we knew that, was it Stacked Cards?
Yeah,
I think
Cards did. Yeah, I have that on our blog. Yeah.
Yeah, so now we got to be on the lookout for the tape version of, I guess, this whole album. The whole album with Batman and Robin running on the beach. That particular album is on tape somewhere. So,
do you still have a cassette player anywhere in the house?
Yeah, I actually do. I've got my record player's got a tape player in it. So.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Well, yeah. Your birthday's in December. We'll have to, you know, I'll try and get together with Cindy and see what we can do for that. So,
oh, cool. Thank you.
And then one of the things we wanted to mention before we do our traditional sign-off is we found out a piece of very interesting Power Records information. We've been going on and on and on and on about how we never know who any of the actors are in these records. We only could find little pieces of information. Brian Washington is very good at finding out some of the stuff, but for the most part, we still don't know who really worked on these records. Well, just a couple of days ago, our pal Scott X, friend of the network and a guest on this very show, tweeted at me a bunch of tweets that he noticed and he thought I would find interesting, which I did. Jim Imbruglia, on Twitter posted the Batman LP power record, the one of Batman with the four villains, just out of nostalgia. And then another guy named Joe Blevins responded to that with a link to an episode of the podcast radio show This American Life, which I used to listen to. I haven't listened to in a long while. But it was from an episode number 121 from 1999, and it was a biography of an actor and kind of all-around Rolling Stone, a guy named Keith Aldrich. And it was basically his life story about this guy that kind of just moved from place to place, changed jobs, seemingly kind of dropped families after he kind of got bored with them and, like, created a new family. And, like, he really lived this very peripatetic, crazy life. But weird detail – he happened to write the story, If Music Be the Food of Death, and he played Batman. He was Batman. And they even play a clip in the episode. So now we know the actor playing Batman in that story is Keith. His name is Keith Aldrich. You can find him on IMDb. He appeared in a lot of soap operas. He wasn't necessarily a big actor. But now we know that's the name of the guy that was Batman. What an amazing random piece of information.
Yeah, that was a fascinating listen too. I mean, that guy. I mean, they talked about how he was the American idea of reinventing yourself to an extreme.
Not exactly dad of the year.
No, he sure didn't. And yeah, not exactly who you want. You know, it's more like the modern Batman in a lot of ways in that respect, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Yeah, he. I guess he was also. I think that was the same voice on Stacked Cards,
right.
Too. If I recall right, so that's that same. It's a little bit different than the Robin. It's a different actor than Robin Meets Man Bat, but I think those particular two Batman stories, that's him. So yeah, that was really fascinating. Thanks to everybody that tweeted that over, and all the chain of people, we somehow got this information because that's wonderful to have.
Yeah, I mean, they don't get into. If you listen to the episode again, it's episode 121. From 1999, they don't get into how he became Batman because they really focus more on about the kind of, frankly, personal wreckage he left behind in his life. But we never know how he ended up working for Power Records and why. And they actually do play clips of him in other contexts, and he doesn't sound like Batman. So clearly when he was playing Batman, he was doing a Batman voice kind of thing. But he was an actor. So, I mean, I guess it makes sense. But they just talk about that, how he briefly played Batman, and they, you know, they said the kids wanted him to be, you know, they like he was not exactly the superhero that he played in real life, and but nevertheless, it's a great big piece of information of the many missing pieces of the Power Records puzzle. It's nice to have one of these now that we know. Okay, Keith Aldrich played Batman. At some point, we'll have to like do like a Google Doc and just start piecing it together. Like, who played Superman? Who played Wonder Woman? And just start slotting these in as we learn these things. So again, big, big thanks to our pal Scott X who hipped me to the whole thread to that episode. So that's a fascinating, you know, little piece of information. So thank you so much, Scott X. So I guess that's going to do it for this episode of the Power Records podcast. Big thanks to our pal Brian Heiler for coming by. He's been on a bunch of shows across the Fire and Water Podcast Network, but this is his first appearance on Power Records, and we will have him back for more Space 1999. I don't know about you, Chris. It sounds like those other stories were even more interesting than the ones we covered in this one.
I tell you what, too, I've watched they adapted two of the ones I have watched. I've only watched three episodes of Space 1999 so far, but they managed to adapt two of them that I really enjoyed, and I would love to have seen them do a comic of those two, because there's some grisly stuff that happens in those two episodes that really shocked me. It's like, wow, this was on TV in the 70s, really? So I know there's not a comic, unfortunately, but I would have loved to seen Russ Heath draw some of these god-awful things that happen to these people in these comics.
That's a shame they didn't do any more booking records then. We just have just the audio adventure to listen to. But still, they sound like a lot of fun. And I will have to check out more episodes of the show. They were available on YouTube, actually, via Shout Factory's YouTube channel. And they're all there for free. So that's how I watch them. I spent part of my Sunday afternoon watching Space 1999 episodes. So, of course, you can find back episodes of this show on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com /FW podcast, and there you're going to unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to David Branning, David Ace Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, and RW Lovejoy for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network and the Power Records Podcast specifically. So that is going to do it for this episode. It's always, I'm always happy to do another Power Records with you, Chris. I'm always happy to talk about these records. We'll be back sooner rather than later. But so again, leave feedback on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And until the next episode, drop the needle
and turn the page.
Come, Robin, into the Batmobile and home.